Consequence Podcast Network.
The Psychoanalysis Podcast explores the ways that horror movies examine mental health issues. It deals with mature and sometimes disturbing subject matter, and it may not be suitable for all listeners. It is meant for entertainment purposes only, and not as a substitute for proper therapy. If you or a loved one are currently experiencing mental health difficulties, please contact your local mental health center.
Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out.
Breathe in.
Breathe out.
This is Psychoanalysis.
This is Psychoanalysis, a horror therapy podcast analyzing the horror genre through the lens of mental health. I'm Jen Adams.
I'm Lara Unnerstall.
And I'm Mike Snoonian.
And today we're joined by a special guest. He is the co-host of the Scarred for Life podcast, editor of We Are Horror, and the creator of Gaily Dreadful, Terry. Welcome, Terry.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
We're so excited to have you here. Hey. So this is a comfort horror episode, and we define comfort horror as the movies that don't really scare us but actually make us feel better. And we're talking about a classic comfort horror movie today. Terry, what are we watching?
Oh, we are watching the Blob remake from 1988, released 30 years after the original one.
Hell yes.
Oh, wow. And this was a first watch for me, so I'm so excited to talk about it.
Oh, I'm excited to hear your thoughts on it.
But before we do all of that, we are going to give a brief synopsis in case you haven't seen The Blob or it's been a while. So here is your spoiler alert. Pew, pew. Okay. I don't know what a blob would sound like making a spoiler, I guess.
Well, the caption on the screen is always like saying, was it slimy gurgling noises?
Yes, slimy gurgling. Nice. I'll try not to do that directly into the microphone right now. Just for
I would probably say
sakes.
It we'll sounds like it chili post. Farts. Like chili farts is what I think it sounds.
I was going
like.
To say when you had GAC in the 90s and you made GAC. It make fart farting
oh, yeah.
noises.
What yeah. is GAC?
What?
What
okay.
is GAC?
It's like if chili fart were a toy.
Okay.
It's the slime.
It's GAC.
It's okay. You know how slime is a thing now? It was yes. also a thing in the 90s.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a sidebar we'll save. Okay, I'm going to read the synopsis now.
All right.
The small-town streets of Blobville are deserted. Everyone is at the local high school football game, where we meet our hero, Meg. She's a cheerleader and gets asked out by Paul, a receiver on the team, right after he crashes into the water table. Meanwhile, local bad boy Brian Flagg, two G's, any relation? It's a little King's Dominion for you, is busy moping and doing motorcycle tricks in the woods. He's complicated.
Is he?
He's complicated.
He has a motorcycle, so yes.
And a mullet.
He's complicated. Yes.
And I'm going to never stop talking about this mullet. The town sheriff is looking for love at the local diner. And there's an unhoused gentleman in the woods who sees a meteor crash in a clearing. He investigates and pulls a blob of goo from the meteor's steaming crevice. I'm sorry. So that's what it is.
I mean, it's
okay. How else am I supposed to say it? Suddenly, that goo grabs his hand.
Gotta watch out for that.
Yep. A lot of warning tales in this movie.
Sorry.
Salty discharge.
I don't know. No comment. He runs through the woods, scares the shit out of Flag, and careens into the road, only to be hit by Paul and Meg driving to their first date. But that's not the only date in town. Paul's jock friend is making out with a gal named Vicky at Lover's Lane. He gets out to open his sex prep cartender trunk. There are strawberries in there, lots of alcohol, a box full of class rings he can use to make girls feel special, and a blender to mix drinks with, all of which is completely normal and not a huge red flag.
Mm-hmm.
He gets back inside the car only to find that Vicky has fallen asleep. He takes this as an excuse to get inappropriate and reach into her blouse, but never fear, this blobby grabs back. I'm sorry. Well, the future is blob mail. Okay, I'll stop. I really deeply apologize. Okay, what I'm trying to say is she's been taken over by the blob, and it blobs his date rapey ass, but also kills Vicky. Can't win them all.
Yep.
Okay. I recover from that one. Okay. Whew. Back on the road, Meg, Paul, and Flag put the injured man in the car and take him to the hospital. At the hospital, Meg and Paul proceed to have the best date ever. When Paul gets up to grab a soda, he stumbles on the injured man, who is mid-blobification. His body is distended and distorted and generally getting blobified. Paul runs into another room and calls the police. But before they can do anything, Paul also gets blobbed. Ah! Finally, we see the fully realized blob. Saying the word blob this much is a lot. Okay.
I'm loving the amount of times and ways they were using blob in this. I've got to say.
It's a verb, it's an adjective, it's exactly.
It could be an adverb.
Pretty much, it's like that moose sentence, but blah, 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 blah. Okay. Finally, we see the fully realized blob, a huge writhing mass of pink goo with corrosive properties. It grows with every human it eats. It's pretty cool, TBH. Meg sees it consume Paul, then gets knocked unconscious. Naturally, the authorities don't believe her. The blob rampages through town, mostly through the sewers, consuming person after person. Meg sneaks out of her house and tracks down Flag outside the local diner. She's convinced that he'll believe her because he's moody and has an extremely luscious mullet. Flag goes into the diner to have a sandwich. There they converse when suddenly, the blob is back! It's back, baby! It takes out the cook and the waitress. Flag and Meg hide from it in the freezer where it tries to reach them, but suddenly draws back. Could this be foreshadowing? Mm-hmm. Meg and Flag flee the diner and head back to the woods where they found the old man to investigate. Meanwhile, the town reverend comes across the destroyed diner and finds some glittering pink crystals at the threshold of the freezer. Could this also be foreshadowing? Out in the woods, Meg and Flag run into a mysterious government biohazard team. They're wearing hazmat suits, and the leader seems to be pretty nice and helpful.
Spoiler alert, he's not.
I bought it, man. I was like, he's nice.
He seemed like he knew what he was doing.
Right.
But it turns out these hazmat dudes are not on the side of good, especially the evil Dr. Hazmat. In fact, he's responsible for creating the blob, a biological weapon that got out of hand. Whoopsie doopsie. Evil Dr. Hazmat is willing to sacrifice everyone in the town to contain, but preserve the blob for future war stuff. But these G-men weren't counting on bad boy Brian Flagg. Meanwhile, Meg's little brother and friend have snuck off to see a slasher flick in a movie theater. While the audience watches unaware, the blob takes a moment to get revenge on a spoiler-shouting moviegoer before blobbing everyone in the theater. Meg, brother, and friend escape into the sewers, but the blob is there too. Sadly, Meg's brother's friend gets blobbed. He seemed kind of sketchy, though, so whatever. I'm just kidding. He's a sweet little boy. Sweet little boy.
He's a 12-year-old little Muppet.
I'm fucking around. Okay. Or am I? Anyway, she gets her brother out safely, and Flag is there to help her out, but not before an inexplicable motorcycle chase scene in the sewers. How'd he get the bike down there? We'll never know, and frankly, we don't want to know. Evil Dr. Hazmat tries to seal everyone in the sewers with the blob to contain it, but Flag just happens to find a bazooka. He bazookas out of the sewers and they escape. The blob kills Evil Dr. Hazmat and blobs on down the street, collecting souls, growing exponentially, and creating total pandemonium.
Blobdemonium, I believe, is the scientific term.
Panda blobmonium. Okay, I'll stop. Okay. Having a stroke. Turns out the secret weapon is cold, as foreshadowed earlier. Cue a giant snow truck that explodes. Oh yeah, it's a ski town in the winter, by the way. Beautiful life-saving snow rains down, freezing the blob into thousands of pink crystals. The town is saved. Or is it?
Bum, bum, bum.
As the final stinger, we see the Reverend. His face is half burned off from a close encounter with the blob, and he's leading a tent revival. Judgment Day is coming soon. But when? He lifts up his jar of blob and intones that he's just waiting on God to give him a sign. And that's the blob!
The blob!
If you took out Scott Baio in Arrested Development and replaced him with the Blob, you would have Blob.
What point in this episode is Blob just going to lose all sense of meaning?
It's already happening. Yeah. Just getting through that synopsis was challenging. Right. For you.
Well, so now let's do a feelings check. And this is where we share our first experience with the Blob and how it makes us feel when we watch it. And now I just want to like start throwing the word Blob in for random words and just but that would be maybe a little
becoming like a Pawnee Pool thing.
Pawnee Pool, that's the movie I was thinking. And so Terry, this was your choice, and I would love to hear about your first experience with the Blob and how it makes you feel.
Well, I was first blobbed when I was I think 8 or 9 is when I first saw this film. And I had grown up watching the original Blob starring Steve McQueen from 1958, actually. And I grew up watching that because my dad loved the kind of old-fashioned horror movies, particularly in his case, Universal, but then also up into like the 50s with Hammer and some of the sci-fi movies. And so I watched that one a whole lot. And once like my parents decided that I could maybe handle some R-rated films, they started to introduce me to more. And this one was a favorite because it hit that sweet spot of being like very imaginative and very colorful. But also there's a kind of a lack of, there's nudity in it. There's not much at all. There's some implied sexual overtones and assault, which I didn't realize when I was a kid. But like, it was enough that my parents let me just watch it. And so I would watch this movie over and over and over and over again. And at this time, I lived in Alaska, and I was an introvert. I still am an introvert. But being kind of the son of being a military brat, basically, where I was stationed in Alaska with my father, people would come and go. I didn't have a lot of friends. And so I spent a lot of time watching movies. And it was sort of, I mean, looking back on it now, I kind of see it as sort of like a coping mechanism that I had back then. But what I would do is I'd watch a lot of these movies. And then because it was the vast Alaskan wilderness, like right outside of my door, I'd be outside in the forest and play acting what I saw and what I watched. And so watching this film and watching films like it became sort of a way of me being able to exercise like my imagination afterwards. And I remember in particular being so convinced that there was going to be a sequel to this movie. Little Terry didn't realize that this was a box office bomb. And it had ended with the, you know, the Reverend saying like, there's going to be doomsday. And I was, for the next few years, I was like, when is this next movie going to come out? When is the sequel going to come out? When is the sequel going to come out? And so I remember, I have a vivid memory of taking the slime from Ghostbusters toys and pretending that was the Blob and kind of using like He-Man and G.I. Joe figures to like somehow create a sequel to this movie. So this movie was like, precious for little Terry. And now I don't know, it kind of surprised me that I don't look back on it as sort of like a memory of the loneliness that I did have, but like instead I see it as that as a comfort that I still had from when I was a kid, as one of those things that I would use to entertain myself, basically.
Aww. That's really sweet.
I know. Mike, what about you?
Yeah, I have like really warm memories of this as well. Like this would have been a staple of like late 80s, early 90s, like cable television for sure. Mm. And my parents are weird in that like I could not watch R-rated movies until the day I turned 17. Heck, I mean, we snuck them in, obviously, but like 16 years, 364 days old, like, nope, that's a grounding. but the minute I turned 17, it was A-okay. But the Blob, for whatever reason, was A-okay. And I think it's because my dad had this real affinity for like 1950s like science fiction, which this would have been obviously a remake of. And like, I, even though this was like really gory and bloody, like he let me get away with this one. So I just have a lot of memories of watching this over and over on cable TV. Obviously the poster with like Paul, like kind of like sticking out, like all kind of goofified, is one of the things that sticks in the memory.
So gnarly. So,
oh yeah. You know, so this to me is, it just reminds me of like sitting in the basement living room with my dad and my mom and like having the kind of cable box where if you took a sliver of a Coke can and slid it under the little adapter, you would get every station for free back in the day. So it was like one of the early cable box tricks. And like watching, so I probably owe now out of commission cable company a lot of money and they're going to come after me. So this definitely stuck with me as something that I saw like either all the way through or huge chunks of like over and over again. And then last year, Scream Factory released like their special edition of this disc. And it was like a day one pre-order for me, which I usually don't do because as much as I love them, like they tend to be a little bit expensive and I'll wait till stuff goes on sale. But this was like a no-brainer. And it just brought back like a ton of warm memories. I have it up there. There are three remakes from the 80s. There's Cronenberg's The Fly, Carpenter's The Thing, and I think Russell's The Blob. I think make the big three of remakes and show how you can do it really well. And we'll talk maybe more when we get into the movie where Carpenter and Cronenberg ran as far away from like the campy drive-in roots as they could and gave us like much more serious fare. Like Chuck Russell really embraced the kind of cornballness of the early original movie and was able to kind of like embrace it in a way, but still modernize it. It's just got this, even though it's like really bloody and gory and like the special effects are incredible, and it does things that no movies really do. Like movies don't typically kill 12-year-old Muppets in such disgusting ways. Even with that all in there, it's just like it's a warm, tender movie in a lot of ways, and I absolutely adore it.
Laura, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that. I especially the comparison of The Fly and The Thing. I do definitely group this in with those movies. If you know, but and you know, I hadn't really thought of them all being remakes, all kind of coming out within the same stretch of time. And for some reason, I never made that connection. But I really make the sort of practical effects. They all have a vibe that I think, even though they're all three very different movies, they all feel very spiritually related to me. And I also just friggin' love the special effects in this movie. Yeah. I love those kind of practical effects. This is like pinnacle of 80s creature effects to me. As is a theme on this show, I have no strong memory of the first time I saw it, but I know this one, I do remember that I saw, I'm pretty sure shortly after college, like maybe in like 2009 or 2010, and I had missed it. I was kind of like going, and I had seen The Thing and The Fly a bunch of times, and like, I was just kind of going through and trying to like obsessively catch up on a bunch of horror movies that I hadn't seen before. I remember I had this huge list and I was working my way through it. And this one just blew me away. So fun, such an enjoy, just like from beginning to end is so entertaining. Just such a, and like, you're right, Mike, like there's so much like fucked up shit that happens, but for some reason it doesn't penetrate my brain in a disturbing way. It just hits me as like action-packed fun romp. There is a lot of stuff we could unpack, and I'm sure that we will in the larger conversation, especially like I think that assault scene kind of mostly flew over my head, or it didn't have the effect, you know, the effect on me that it did now, for what, you know, whatever reason. I blame the early 2000s. But you know, I just think that there's so much going on, and I think that it has a lot of reversal of expectations, strong female protagonist, really great teamwork between the Megan Flagg characters that I really enjoy. There's just so much to enjoy in this movie. And it's, like you said, it's colorful. It's fun. Fun is the word I keep coming back to, yeah. Along with blob.
Yeah, this was the first watch for me, and I have been aware of this movie and the original because I read Danse Macabre, and this is, I feel like, one King talks about kind of this like 50s era of sci-fi horror movies, and it's not ever a genre that I've been particularly drawn to. And so I kind of just avoided this one. And I think I was kind of aware that there was a remake, but I also tend to not, I have movies that I have decided are gross in my mind. And those, even if I haven't seen them, I'm like, that looks gross. I don't think I'm going to do that. And so I kind of been avoiding this one. And I also thought The Blob was going to be really slow, you know, and I was like, oh, they're just going to be running and screaming from like molasses or something, right? But man, this blob is action-packed, man. This blob will like grab you and suck you through things, and it's got like arm tentacle things. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, this was so much fun, and it reminds me of the pink slime in Ghostbusters 2, which is my favorite of the franchise. Yep. So I think that was kind of my in, and I was like, oh, that's not gross, that's like the mood slime, you know. This was so much fun. It was also like people kept popping up in this movie that I was like, oh, I know you. I love you. Like Dr. Romano from ER is like the surly deputy whose name I can't remember with the mustache. And yes. I talked about my feelings for Jeffrey DeMunn, I think, in our Hitcher episode. But man, young Jeffrey DeMunn is hot. And I was into it. And it's just, yeah, you're right. There's a strong female antagonist. There is a good central relationship that never really turns romantic, which is another thing that I enjoy. Not that I think that's bad. I just think you don't always have to have your two male and female characters hook up, you know? And so I enjoyed that that never happened. There were some parts that got me, like the kid dying, and then like Jeffrey DeMunn and Diner Lady are about to find love. And
I know.
And it's ripped away by the blob. And I was like, I kept thinking they were going to get unblobified, you know, because it's just like, if a blob can get you, maybe they can find a way to unblob you. And it just doesn't, you know. So I think, you know, it was just fun. But I think it's the kind of movie that has more beneath the surface, too, which is
absolutely
like my jam. So yeah, this was, I'm so glad that I was introduced to this movie. So thank you for choosing this, because it was so much fun. So.
I mean, this was literally like the first, I went around trying to think of what movie to bring. And this was literally the first film that popped in my head when you said comfort horror. And I was like, I don't know, maybe I could think of something, you know, maybe something better. But like, no, this movie is fucking fantastic.
And it is
perfect. And it had been so long since I watched it that I was just delighted to have an excuse to rewatch it. So yeah. Thank you. Good choice.
Yeah, I was watching the title sequence and I was getting like, first the music reminded me of Terminator, and then the opening credit scene reminded me of Quantum Leap, and then like the whole town being deserted reminded me of The Stand, and I was like, this is amazing, I love this. So
The opening also has strong Twin Peaks vibes to me, and I think it's like all the like town characters and they're all their interrelated ways, and then it just completely tumbles it all over and turns it into its own thing.
Well, I think one thing this movie does really well, and a lot of movies of this era do it well, but The Blob in particular, is Darabont and Russell's script gives all of its characters moments where you get to know them and you get some insight into them. So even though the sheriff and the diner waitress, even though they're not on screen for that much, you kind of get like a really nice peek into their characters, and you get just enough where you start to care about them, and then they're killed off. So there's like an impact there. And it's not the kind of impact that I think like a lot of horror after 2001 did, where it's like you would meet a character and immediately dislike them. And you would immediately question whether the writer of the film ever had friends, because it's not typically how friends interact with one another. Where this one, so you don't root for those characters, you root for them to die. You root for the villains. And like, it's not fun to root for the villains. It is, it's sort of fun, but you know, I think at the end of the day, you kind of want characters that you care about so that you feel something when they actually get killed. And this movie kills so much misdirection, and it pulls like a lot of like Psycho moments where the person you think is the lead character is killed off like very quickly.
I almost put the phrase psycho twist in the synopsis, but I thought it was too many words. So
and then it does it at least two more times, maybe three if you count like the little kid who gets killed. Like people that you think are gonna like factor into the ending in a big way are killed off pretty unceremoniously.
Yeah, like he says, and I can't remember what he says, but it's like, I'll never watch another movie again or something like that. And I thought he was going to get through it and they were going to have their celebratory, see, we're watching another movie moment at the end. And no, it was ripped away.
I love that moment because there is kind of a sort of sardonic meanness to this film at the kind of that scene in particular, watching it this time. I mean, because I've watched it so many times, but you know, I was sitting here actually taking notes. I was like, oh, that's actually kind of funny in a darkly humorous sort of way, because if you've seen this before, you know, he ain't going to see another movie. And how vicious of a death that one was. Yeah.
I know. And he's 12, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to see that movie too. Like whatever movie they were watching, I was like, what's going on? And then I realized it was a movie in a movie. And it's like, that's awesome.
I love a movie in a movie gag also. Yeah. It's just one of my little fun things.
And this was a fun one because it's like this movie already has an element of camp. Mm-hmm. And so it's like the camp was just ratcheted up just like maybe one or two notches. So you're like, this feels a little bit off, but I still buy it for this movie. And then, and then pan back. I'm like,
yes. I think we're kind of in the movie discussion, so I'll say, sorry. It happened organically, which is great. But I think like we usually started off by saying like, why do we find this movie comforting? Mm-hmm. And I think that like, although these things that we're saying, like the death of this child and stuff are really vicious, like you said, Terry, it is done in a very like darkly funny way. And it makes it feel more like a dark comedy than a straight up horror, at least to me. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that's part of why it isn't hitting that part of my brain that gets disturbed by things. I don't know if you feel that way also.
Yeah. You know, I do think this movie's never scared me. Even when I was a little kid watching it, it never scared me. I was more into the practical effect side of things, I think. But as an adult, even though the deaths kind of hurt, like the kid didn't really bother me, because I'm gonna be honest, I love when kids are in peril in movies, because it doesn't happen very often. It's sort of like a taboo topic, and so when it happens, I'm like, ooh, movie's gonna go there, and it's a movie from the 80s that's going there. I was like, so I'm sorry for all the parents out there, and I'm like, yes, put those kids in danger.
Absolutely, put as many children into danger as possible.
And I do want to point out that Mike is a parent, so process
my child
that
is right behind me right now.
But you know what really I've started, because I did a double feature this week, and I watched the original Blob, because it'd been probably a good 20 years since I've seen it. Have any of you seen the original?
I've never seen it in its entirety. I've seen bits of it, but I've never seen the whole Blob.
It's kind of boring.
It's a bit dull. It's amazing that Steve McQueen would go on to be the king of cool.
Oh, he is dorky awful as heck in this movie. Yeah. He's 28 years old playing a 17-year-old. Yes. And he looks like he's been...
He looks 45.
He looks like he's been smoking off a lot, because he has like age lines on his forehead. And he does this kind of like hulking over, like where he's just sort of like scrunched over the entire time. I'm like, how is this Steve McQueen that you know, you would go on to do The Great Escape and whatnot?
It's got that killer Burt Bacharach theme song.
Oh my God, that song is the best.
It's so good.
But it's what I was thinking about this movie when I think you were talking, Jen, about how you didn't think it would be scary because it's, you know, it's just going to be slow as molasses. And in that original movie, it literally is this little blob that just sort of like squiggles back and forth. And then you'll see it like move a little bit. But like, yeah, it was definitely a different kind of original film than what we got in the 80s.
What's interesting too is like, this is the writing directing team that brought us A Nightmare in Elm Street 3. Mm-hmm. So you're a year removed from what is by a lot of fans considered like the best of the franchise. And it's the one that shifted Freddy's character from being like really, really dark to still dark and scary, but also very quippy and very funny. And I would say it's like the birth of like MTV Freddy.
Yes.
Is what you see in Elm Street 3, where he's like, you know, welcome to prime time and all the other remarks they have. So, you know, Darabont would go on obviously to win an Oscar for Shawshank Redemption. Yeah. He would go on to start the Walking Dead TV series before he left, I think after the first season, definitely by season two. Chuck Russell doesn't get the same, I think, acclaim that maybe he's due. When you look at this guy's career, he turned Elm Street into like a blockbuster series. Like it became the highest grossing horror movie of the year. And then like not too long after, he launches both Cameron Diaz and Jim Carrey's careers with The Mask in 94, in 96. You could say that he gave Arnold one of his like last bona fide standalone hit movies with The Eraser. And then he helms The Rock's first starring vehicle with The Scorpion King. And I don't think he really did a lot after that. I think after The Scorpion King, I don't even know if he's directed anything, but he's one of those guys that like, you could see him as kind of like a kingmaker. In the 80s, the 90s and 2000s, he helped launch some big careers. So
I did almost write that the tagline for this movie should be, with like coming out of the blob, like, somebody stop me. I'm sorry that I said that out loud.
It would have to be green. I mean, there's your sequel, you know.
Yes, if we can combine the mask with the blob. Oh my God. I'm sorry. I completely agree. And I think Dream Warriors is usually the one that I go and watch when I like that mm-hmm. is like my I'll watch the first Nightmare on Elm Street as a comfort horror, but I mean when I think of like comfort horror Nightmare on Elm Street, I always go to Dream Warriors and I'll watch it like over and over, and it just yep. like it just has that exact same fun zany energy as this movie, and it is a very particular sweet spot and a very particular moment in time, and I don't think you can make a movie exactly like that yeah. anymore.
Yeah. I just recently saw Dream Warriors for the first time. And I think I grew up having some very definite biases against certain types of horror movies. And I was like, nah, I'm not going to like that. And I just didn't ever choose to watch it. And Freddy was one of them. And I was like, nah, he's too quippy for me. And I watched Dream Warriors and I was like, this is fantastic. Why have I robbed myself of all of these movies for so long? You know, I think I always really just wanted to be scared. And if I didn't think it was going to scare me, I was like, nope.
Sure. I understand that.
So I'm watching all these 80s movies now. I'm like, this is amazing. Why was I missing this? You know, so.
This is definitely one of my favorite eras. I do like to be scared, but I also like to have like a zany fun time. And that's when yeah. I always go to these mm-hmm. movies.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Terry, about what you have to say about like how this is kind of an answer to the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
50s one. Yeah. I thought that was an interesting insight that I hadn't thought of at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the 50s, and this really was brought home rewatching both of them kind of back to back this weekend. The 50s edition has a very golly gee feel to it, where it's like the Steve McQueen, he gets in trouble with the law for driving backwards down a street. Like that's the extent of the shenanigans that gets pulled in this town. And it's very much the police are there to protect you. They don't necessarily believe them in the beginning, because who's going to believe? It's the same situation as here. Who's going to believe that there's this blob of something that is dissolving people and it doesn't leave anything behind? So obviously there's no like evidence, right? So there's that initial pull where the police don't believe him, but by the end of the film, the police are there shooting the thing. They're trying to save the people that are trapped in the diner that the blob is covered over. They call the military and the military comes in, and ultimately between the entire town coming together as one to save the day, they freeze the monster and the military drop it into the Arctic, where it will stay until the Arctic ever melts. Like, oh, hello. Oh,
2020. Oh, no.
Yeah. But like, everyone is working together. The police are there to help you. The military is there to save your butt at the very end. It's very, very 1950s. Golly gee, mm-hmm. we're going to be okay. Trust the people that are running things to get things done. And so this film, while it does have a lot of camp and it definitely takes some of the sequences from that movie and kind of reinvents them, there's a scene in the theater in both movies. For instance, there's the sort of the old man that gets blobbed in the beginning, but it kind of subverts those expectations by, this is not a meteor, this is a satellite that our government put up in the space to do biological warfare for. It's being covered up by scientists, being covered up by the government, and they have decided that they're going to quarantine this town because it's like a biological weapon. It's a virus, in other words. We're going to quarantine this town. Everyone's expendable. It sort of kind of tackles that same vibe as like Alien, where it's like, we must have this organism, right? Mm-hmm. And so it takes that sort of nihilism and creates this thing where the people that are there to protect us can't. The sheriff gets eaten. The deputy gets split in half. It's actually the people themselves that end up rising up against this thing and rising up against authority to basically say, no, we are going to protect ourselves and save the day. So it feels like it is taking the kind of themes that were introduced in that original one and saying, no, this is not that same kind of 1950s golly gee that you're probably expecting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which, yeah. I feel like at the 80s, that was really trying to, at least where I grew up, was being like rammed down my throat. Like, trust the government. It's
oh, yeah.
good. The 50s were the magical time. And I mean, yep. we're still hearing that now, you know? So I think like, I really loved that element of the movie, you know?
This is a movie too that comes out like right at the height of the Iran-Contra
right.
scandal as well. Like the hearings are going on. And there is like, we talked about paranoia when we did The Burbs and we did Fright Night. But this is a movie that also fits very well. And there's a thread of like government paranoia that runs throughout movies in the 80s, whether it's even child fare like E.T. You see that. You see that in movies like War Games, where we can't be trusted. But this is a movie where there's a vast government conspiracy that's being withheld. And you see like the scientists are there under the government's direction, and you see they have no qualms. Like, they're not there to protect the citizens. They actually have no problem saying that the citizens are going to be expendable. Mm-hmm. And that just, and this is just like a quick little excerpt from the executive summary's finding and conclusions of the Iran-Contra hearings, where the common ingredients of the Iran and Contra policies were secrecy, deception, and disdain for the law. A small group of senior officials believed they alone knew what was right. They viewed the knowledge of their actions by others in the government as a threat to their objectives. So you have like this movie that comes out right in the height of the federal government being accused of like covering things up, and that the people don't have a right to know. And I think that's a thread you see in a lot of movies of the 80s, where on one hand you're saying trust the people, trust the helpers, or to the other hand you're saying like don't trust people in charge.
Yeah, and I was gonna say, like, again, having watched this in the early 2000s and then watching it now, it hit a little different given COVID and everything, you know. Mm-hmm. Just those themes of, and I think if you were to make The Blob again, if you made it on a 30-year cycle, what would happen would be this blob comes out of nowhere. No one can figure out where or why. We try to get help from the government, and then they say there's no blob. And then all the people in the town tear each other apart. Yep. in their panic over not knowing what to do. And there's probably a culture war about whether or not the blob exists also. Yeah. So it was just kind of like, at one point I was like, oh, how quaint, evil but competent officials. Mm-hmm. What? Like, anyway.
Yeah. I think nowadays, you know, scientists who say, hey, don't touch the blob, it can hurt you. And then people would be like, oh, you got to go hug that blob. We got to like get herd immunity. Just go give it a big hug.
Just go ahead. Yeah, there's a scene immunity of a bunch of people running yeah into the blob. Yeah.
Not touching the blob and pinches on my freedom, man.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Well, and that's one of the things, I didn't realize that until you pointed it out, but I think that's part of the tone, is we don't see the townspeople turn against each other. And I'm thinking of another Frank Darabont movie, The Mist, where there's that threat outside. And one of the things I love about zombie movies or trapped movies is that you find that the people are the real monsters in a lot of ways. Yeah. And you don't really see that here. It's the government. And I feel like Evil Dr. Hazmat is a villain, but it's like he exists as part of this government system rather than an individual. And his turn feels really harsh. Like, I really want to believe him.
Well, he has a very friendly face, and he talks with that sort of, you know, oh gosh, I am, it's that golly gee of the 50s, it's I'm here to help you, it's we are, you know, we're it's good thing that we're here, we're going to solve this problem, stay away from that thing, don't go look at it, because, you know, it's contagious, we don't want it to infect you. And then the turn later, where all of a sudden, you know, he's driving a van over the manhole to keep them down, and then he's ultimately trying to shoot them, and he's saying, oh, he's infected. Like, that turn is really vicious to
You feel very betrayed by that character, you know, and really good casting as well, because he does have that super friendly grandpa kind of face.
And there's, I can't remember exactly what he says, but at the beginning when he's talking to Meg and Flag, like, I think he's saying, like, no, you're important, we want to hear what happened. Like, he believes them, and it's the first person that they've really encountered who wants to help. And it just, and that's something I feel like we don't see a lot. Like, a lot of times when we see this kind of government takeover, I'm thinking of like the Crazies. It's like they just swarm the town, and it's like faceless soldiers, you know, rather than like a scientist coming to say, no, we're here to help you, you know, we care about you. And then to find out that they don't, you know.
I think this movie does a really good job too of depicting the kind of communities that I wonder if they still exist in this country, where, you know, you walk into the neighborhood drugstore and the pharmacist immediately knows your name, and the condom So the buying the condom scene is something that Russell took from his own life. Like that was a
story
from his own life where his friend said, oh, you know, like I need to buy these condoms for my buddy over there. And then when he went to pick up his date, like that dad answered the door.
That's wild.
So saying like now there wouldn't even be a neighborhood pharmacist at this point. Like it would be a CVS or a Walgreens where no one knows you. And I think that there is something that's been lost that we don't really know our neighbors anymore. We're not like the movie pulls like a really great sleight of hand in the first 2 minutes where you think like it's almost like Day of the Dead, where it feels like a completely deserted and isolated community. And you think that you're almost coming in at the end of the movie and then it's going to flash back to how it got this way. Mm-hmm. But what is like everybody is at the local high school football. Yep. That's the big community, which is a real thing in some communities mm-hmm. where like that is like their that's their culture. They all whether or not they have kids in high school, they go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I actually had to rewind because I thought I missed 1 month before. You know, right. I did that twice.
Easily be excused for thinking that. But I think that there's, you know, part of the reason why the town can come together is because they all do feel like they're invested in one another's well-being. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Laura, you can probably speak to this just based on like your job and doing so much COVID research, but it feels like for so many people that are like anti-mask or anti-vax or anti-social distancing, the only thing that made them change their mind was when they were personally affected by it. They could not see past, you know, once their husband or their child or themselves personally were affected, they changed their tune, but they could never picture anything outside of their own like 3 foot bubble affecting people.
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously I can't speak to the greater American social experience, but you know, there's something to be said for having a sense of community and for caring about people outside of like your nuclear family unit, you know, or outside of the like little, you know, I hate to use the word bubble because I feel like it's been ruined by discourse that you that you're in. But yeah, blobble outside of your own blobble. But yeah, I mean, it's like I saw some like hot take headline once that was like how the nuclear family, you know, how like prizing the nuclear family over community like created the pandemic or something. But I was like, you know, that I think that there is really something to that sense of like, you know, again, these cliches that we heard at the beginning of all of it, of like, we're in it together. It's like, but actually we are, whether or not you want it that to be the case, right. You know?
Yeah.
But at the same time, a lot of the people who seem to be anti-maskers are the same ones that are like really in, like often very religious, are all about like faith, family, you know, it's like, there's some disconnect happening that I just will fundamentally never fully understand, but something has gone horribly wrong.
Yeah, there's like a core misunderstanding, I think.
Mm-hmm. A fun pairing would be this movie and Jaws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you see two towns taking radically different approaches to this kind of threat, whereas like the town in Jaws is like, the mayor in Jaws is like famously like how, you know, DJT reacted to the pandemic versus the blob, like the townspeople. There's not like a central like authority figure. The authority comes from outside and then the townsfolk like figure it out themselves. So I just think that's an interesting comparison. Yeah.
Except this one has a much higher body count and a much shorter period of time.
That's true. Yeah. You know, the one that I was actually connecting it to, and this is really stupid, is Jack Frost. And I don't know. There's something about the backdrops of some of these buildings or something that just reminded me of Jack Frost. I don't particularly like that movie. I've got some. It's got some issues.
Are we talking about the Killer Snowman one?
Yes. And it could with be the because carrot. There's snow. Yes, with the carrot. Yeah, yeah. That's one of my problems with it. But
I remember the first time I saw that movie. We rented it some weekend because we would just like rent massive movies during the weekend and just like sit down and watch them all. And I remember just thinking, wait, where's the carrot? And then going, oh my god! And yeah, that was my experience with that film.
Yeah.
I bought the Blu-ray of it off of a Vinegar Syndrome table at a thing just because I was like, I'd never seen it. So I kind of just bought it blind and like, I just wanted to support them. And so I just was like, oh, I'll buy this. And then I went home and watched it and was like, well, I will never watch that again. Put it back on the shelf.
Yeah. And I wonder if the thing I was connecting it to is like when they have like the women with the hair dryers and they're like walking forward, like blob Jack Frosting back, like with his heat, that just kind of banding together. But yeah, that scene just about it. Actually, it does ruin the movie for me. It's like, man, there's there's really no going back after that.
Right, I gotta say, for like a government, this is not the greatest government plan, where if you are developing this bioweapon to fight your greatest enemies, you know, considering that we're in the middle of the Cold War and you figure our number one enemy is Russia, this is the same mistake you know. That Hitler made when he had the march to Stalingrad. You do
exactly.
not
and make Napoleon.
A weapon. Yeah, you cannot create a weapon that can be destroyed by the cold if you want to take out Russia, like very easily. And I can only imagine the billions that went into creating the blob, like how much research and development would go into it. But if your like number one weapon that you've spent years creating can be destroyed by like a high school dropout with a mullet and a bad moped, like this is not really American exceptionalism, then takes a massive hit.
Well, from what I understood, just based on the murmurings of the characters in the hazmat suits, like it was a virus or a bacteria that they put into the satellite, and then the pressure of space turned it into a blob, and they were like, oh, that was unexpected. And I don't know, then the rest of the plot happened.
Right. But you gotta have some contingency plans.
What if this is like their backup weapon, you know? This is like, yeah, we'll just put, we were gonna fire Phil, but you know, we got this blob thing we need to figure out, so just, you know, let him figure it out, you know. And they're working on their like Project Blue Captain Trip stuff,
right
in another lab. But
yeah, exactly.
One thing I did want to circle back to though is that we had talked earlier a little bit about the way that this movie kind of upsets expectations with the opening is a great call to that, because you think the town is deserted, you think that it's dying or whatever, and there's like the stuff is rolling through the street by the wind. It definitely sets up that feeling to it. But what I love is the way that, especially if you've seen the original one, it kind of subverts the Steve McQueen role, because you have Meg and you have Paul, and in this initial introduction, it feels like Paul is going to be the Steve McQueen stand-in, that he's going to be the hero, and then no, he gets dissolved immediately in one of the best scenes of like special effects ever. But she actually steps in and becomes the Steve McQueen role, where no one's believing her, just like no one believes Steve McQueen, where she's trying to race it throughout the town and band people together to stand up against it. And that kind of flip of feminism is really kind of interesting, because in the first movie, the women are either hysterical or they're being dragged around, like his girlfriend is just being dragged around through this entire time and just kind of getting into trouble and being the sort of like damsel in distress type role that he has to save and exert his masculinity onto. And so the flip here is really interesting. And then you also have Flag being sort of like that kind of punk ethos of the 80s, right, where he actually becomes the hero, and it comes kind of anti-authoritarian. So the way that those two characters get together is just it's so fascinating, particularly watching it back to back with the 50s.
Yeah. Well,
Flag has definitely just stepped out of a fight between the greasers and the socias. So
yeah, no, when you're a jet, you're a jet all the way.
That made me start snapping.
Blah 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 blah. Okay, so I don't know where I'm going with this. Or what, I had an actual thought. Shit, fuck, hold on.
Oh, no. I really enjoyed having a really strong lead, and also that it's Shawnee Smith, who I do really enjoy. She's never really sexualized in this movie, which I love also. I was really surprised that Paul died. Yeah. I thought he was gonna be the lead. Mm-hmm. He's also dreamy, and I love a movie that sends me down a good where have I seen him before rabbit hole, you know. Which I definitely did with him, and I'm like, ooh, that's fun. But we also have and this is why I love looking at like the female roles, because I think it kind of there's a real time stamps for movies a lot of times, because we have Meg, and then we have her friend whose name I can't remember, which I think is it's Vicky, right?
Vicky
who, yeah.
And there's that scene, which it's not like I don't look at that scene as I look at like the Jack Frost scene, where it's like I can't watch this movie anymore, I can't sign on to this. But it is an interesting like timestamp, you know. It's like this is I do think that he gets the movie makes a statement about how they feel about him, because he does get punished for what he's doing. And I think he's made to be gross. Mm-hmm. Also, like, does he think that the girls at his high school are not going to compare rings and that he's never going to get away with this? You know, also, that's a lot of rings.
That's a lot of rings.
Well, you know, con artists, a lot of men. Con artists, narcissists, psychopaths, they always do something stupid and get caught because of their lack of empathy, as we've discussed in
that's
past
true
episodes.
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, it's funny because the tone of that scene, like rewatching it yesterday, what struck me is how the tone of that scene is definitely comes down on him, like, hey, this isn't something you should be doing, but it's almost like a finger wag in mm-hmm. terms of like the tone that it has. It's almost like a, oh, come on, like, you should know better than this. And I think if you were to do that scene now, I think it would be a lot grimmer.
Yeah.
There's almost like a banter that is in that scene that's really part of the era. Like, if you watch a lot of movies from like the mid to late 80s, like, that's like, it's very much a boys will be boys type mm-hmm. of era. Like,
absolutely.
And if you're not condoning it, you're excusing it as just like, this is part of the male experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's, we've talked about some scenes like that where it's like, I can give some grace for like, this is, you know, maybe a little more progressive at the time. We would do it differently now. But then it's also like, when you're looking at female roles throughout the history of cinema, like, you can't expect this big like woke performance in the 50s, you know, that's mm-hmm. just, you had to walk before we started running. And I really like looking at these scenes and kind of looking at the tone and looking at the way they're staged and the way they treat the female characters there, because I think it just really informs what came before and what comes after, you know.
So I think what I would say is, like, the way that character is written in 1988 versus, like, say 2020, is if Vicky woke up and said, hey, stop, I think in 1988, like, that character would grumble, but he would ultimately stop. You know what I mean? Like, he might complain, but he mm-hmm. would stop. Or I think in 2020, like, that kind of character would be like coded to keep going and keep pushing, even after, like, he wouldn't hear the no. Does that make sense? Like, do you get what I'm saying? Just in terms of like how that kind of character would be written then versus now.
Yeah.
Right. It was played a little bit more for comedy in the 80s versus like someone understanding the need to take that kind of thing more seriously these days.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think like that was one of those scenes where as I was rewatching it, I was like, oh, I'm like, and I know he's going to get blobbed, but like the longer it went on, I was like, just blob him already. Yeah, he did the first button one, button two. And then it's like, come on.
It was getting uncomfortable.
It's very uncomfortable. And it's really gratifying when he does get blobbed, but it's kind of like, well, Vicky had to go along with him to punish him, you know, which is kind of, if you start to pick that apart, it becomes, a little fraught.
And that's where I see the timestamp.
Exactly. You know, and it's like the whole thing. But then again, it's like every aspect of this movie is played for kind of dark comedy. So
right.
It's all just kind of, you know, I'm forgiving the uncomfortableness of it because I think that it's all in keeping with the tone of the overall film. Mm-hmm. But you could really take that scene, pick it apart and say, what is this saying about the attitudes of the time? But I do think, especially for the late 80s, this is a fairly progressive movie, even in the way that they treat the characters. And they are using those expectations of the time against you to constantly be subverting your expectations and keeping you on your toes throughout the film. So,
well, and that scene also kind of, just thinking about it now, kind of reminds me of sort of the EC comics, sort of like darkly, they get their comeuppance in the end, at the end of it. But and the way that scene kind of plays out, where he's obviously the villain of the sequence, and then he ends up, you know, finding his fate because he decided to reach his hand down her, you know, down her shirt. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate that she had to die in it. But I will say that I did love the gore gag of the tentacles popping out of her eyes and like attacking him. I was
it rules. It looks great. It fucking rules. It's just like, it's really disturbing because it's like she's like right up in his face, you know, and like, ugh. Mm-hmm. But
I mean, it's earned.
It's definitely earned.
Yeah. And I'm not one for a lot of practical effects. Like, that tends to not be something I'm really drawn to. But I really liked these effects, as gross as they were. Like, it wasn't like in your face gory where I really had to look away. And I think I wrote great effects and not too gross for a blob, which I was like, yeah, that's what you want. Also, like, a lot of times when they're grabbed, you don't see the blob. It's just like somebody gets, like, Dr. Romano, I think, gets like bent in half, sucked through a like blob hole or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's fun.
the grossest death to me was the guy getting pulled down the sink.
I
love it too. I think it's really cool and fun. And then right after that, her getting crushed in the phone booth, I found that scene really claustrophobic. That was maybe the only moment in the movie where I felt like genuinely a little unsettled, because I'm really claustrophobic. So the idea of like being in a phone booth with this thing, like, you know, consuming you is really very disturbing. I did want to call out, because I was curious, there is a Film School Rejects article on the practical effects and how they did the Blob. And I just have to, I'll only share the very brief, elevator pitch of how they did it, which is puppeteered silk blankets injected with a common food thickener.
Ooh,
that's so fucking cool. Like, this is why I love practical effects, is like, yeah. And I think that they did a mix of like the puppets and then like models. And I don't know what you call it when it almost looks like green screen when it's like,
it's like a front projection screen.
I think it is. It's like rear projection or front projection. I think that those kind of special effects have actually aged pretty well in terms of like, you look at it and you know it's fake, but it still kind of looks good and is really fun to look at. And I freaking love it so much.
Yeah. The scene, kind of talking about that sort of silk blanket, the scene where Paul gets dissolved, he's in like this this body cast, and they pull the blanket over his face so it looks like it's pulling him back. And it's such a simple effect, but it still is aged incredibly well, and it's used in such a convincing manner that it just, I think that's why I personally love practical effects. I love it because even if it doesn't age in particular well, which some effects haven't, it still feels like it's there. It feels like it's part of the scene. Whereas computer generated effects, yeah, they can look great, but they still feel partially removed from the movie. And you can kind of see that in this with the rear projection where it's on the ceiling above them or whatever. But like when they are actually doing those in your face blob effects, it still, in my opinion, holds up till today, just because it is physically present there and there is someone that is interacting with something that is actually there.
And to me, that's a big part of it, is you can always sort of tell in some kind of lizard part of your brain when you're watching CGI. And I think it also does affect performances. I feel like this is a really like snooty cinephile take on it, but like, I all the like blue screen stuff, and there's like the lack of locations, the lack of practical, stuff for actors to interact with. I do feel like it impacts performances, and it just gives a sterility to films that I'm not a huge fan of. And I will always ride or die for practical effects.
I'm right there with you, Laura.
Yeah, I mean, I think digital effects, because they change so quickly and because that technology has changed so quickly, it dates a movie much, much faster than it does than practical effects do. And I think there's also this idea that, like, because with the computer, we can pretty much create anything that we want at this point, they overdo it to the point where it becomes ridiculous, where there's a real simplicity to this creature design, and there's a real simplicity to how it looks that I think as an audience member you can connect with it a lot more. And it's not too busy, there's not too many things going on all at once. Like, your gaze isn't drawn to like 40 different points on the screen. Like, you can really just focus on the creature when it's there, and you can focus on the central point of action, where if you have like a CGI effect, you often get drawn to too many things all at once, and then things just don't blend into the background nearly as good. It doesn't look nearly as seamless. And I'm thinking of like Drag Me to Hell in particular, like the eyeball scene where it's digital blood and digital eyeballs. Like, it immediately sucks you out of the movie
and straight into hell. Sorry.
Yeah. I'm dragged you out of the movie.
And I think does that movie, I mean, not to go on a total digression, but I love that movie, Drag Me to Hell. I think there are some moments in there that use like a combined practical effects and CGI, but I totally agree. The moments where it's very obviously CGI, especially if you compare it to like the Evil Dead movies, which have a lot of that same kind of creature design and same kind of special effects, like the Evil Dead ones are just so much more effective.
Just want to remind our listeners of this show that patrons of the Pod and the Pendulum can hear an hour plus long take this month on Drag Me to Hell.
Oh, I did. I was terrified by that movie, man.
It doesn't hold up.
Well, I still love it, but I mean, but also like going to hell was like my biggest childhood fear, along with pandemics. So if we can just. Yeah. So I've experienced my greatest fear one, and then soon I'll go to hell and experience my second greatest fear. I'm just kidding.
Well, when I think about like effects, I think a lot of times the reason I don't like effects is, and I've talked about, like, I have this big problem with body horror, and that's a lot of times what the effects are. Mm. So practical or CGI, a lot of times it's just something that I don't want to see. And so when it's really well done, it, like, I believe it and I'm like, ah, you know. But I think, like, I don't mind CGI effects when they're really well done. Like, I think about a movie like Jurassic Park, which, like, that movie, like, is such an amazing movie, partially because the effects there are so good. And I think, like, a movie like The Thing that is has these amazing practical effects that are something the film is known for as well. And I think when you do CGI poorly, it is, like we said, really sterile. But when you do practical effects poorly, it's like it almost feels like there's kind of heart and you kind of want to go with them, you know. And I think we've talked about that maybe in our Troll 2 episode, you know.
Maybe, yeah. I remember having a similar conversation to this, but
yeah. But the thing that I really liked about these effects is there's like a heartbreaking quality to it because it's, you can still see the person inside it, you know, like she's looking at Paul, she's seeing him being dissolved. Yep. Like that's terrifying and that's heartbreaking. And they're like reaching out. And I'm also thinking of the little 12-year-old boy who's like reaching for them and he's just getting blobbed. And it's, I think I had in my head the Homer Simpson version of the blob where he's just eating everyone, you know. But there's a magicness to being able to still see the person and seeing what's happening. And for a person like me who does not like a lot of like really gory stuff, there's still that pink covering of everything. Mm-hmm. So none of the effects really bothered me, you know.
There's that moment too when Paul is in the blob and she's trying to pull him out.
Yeah.
And he pulls his arm off. Yeah. So
that's great.
You're just thinking of like the unimaginable pain that must be at that point. Yeah. Is just,
you're just like, it's literally like you're melting. Like, if did you guys watch Chernobyl, HBO series? Like, that's like they show the people who had the radiation fallout and they basically are like dissolving, but it's like the blob, but in slow motion, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, it's just horrifying. But that, now those were some good makeup effects in that show. And I'm positive that was almost all practical and you can tell because it's really upsetting to watch.
Yeah, that arm scene, that was when I knew there was no going back for Paul. Mm-hmm. I was like,
yeah, Paul
is really going to die. Oh, it made me really sad.
You say bye-bye, and then you take the arm and you wave with it.
Can I quote Urban Legend? Bye, Paul. Sorry. I had an Urban Legend on my brain earlier.
We had kind of talked a little earlier about Fran and the sheriff. It goes back to, I can't remember which one of you said this in the sort of intro to the film, but it kind of is like the way that this film allows characters to have a character moment. I think it was you, Mike, that said this, where I loved their sort of kind of meet cute in the beginning where he's at the bar and she's like, Herb, are you trying to ask me out? And, you know, it's just sort of this very kind of playful banter. And he thinks that he kind of struck out, but she's written that, you know, I'll be off at 11 and slips that note to him. And then that's the note later on that's like, oh, I should go check on her to make sure she's okay. And that is what ends up killing him.
Yeah.
And the way,
it's really sad.
The way that whole scene unfolds where she hides in the telephone box and she's on the phone. She's like, oh, well, the sheriff is on his way to the diner. And then you look out and there's the sheriff's face and the blob just melting in front of her. And it's like, it's so heartbreaking. That moment is the most heartbreaking moment of the entire film, because you're like, that is a future that was just crushed because of the government, basically.
All right. Yeah. And again, if you did that scene now, like the sheriff would be awful. You know, he would be like out arresting the wrong people, he would be corrupt, and like the diner matron would be like kicking kids out and like stealing other waitresses' tips, and
she stays, you know, afterwards for flag.
She keeps it open.
It's so nice.
I kept thinking they were related, but no, she's just a kind person and she likes him, you know. Yeah,
see, don't be kind, because that's what's gonna happen.
You're gonna get blobbed, man.
You're gonna get blobbed. And I the only stuff now that is doing this kind of dynamic, I think, are shows like Riverdale and Sabrina, but they are done with such a tongue-in-cheek self, like painful amount of self-awareness that it's, you know, it's they're some simulations of simulations, you know, so nothing means anything anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, it's okay to, like, I watched earlier this morning, I watched Butcher Baker Nightmare Maker, which is
Love that just movie like, so much.
That's a movie to wake up to watch at 6 a.m. Oh. Like, that's a choice I made today.
It's such a ridiculous film.
It's so ridiculous.
It's on Shutter right now, isn't it?
Oh, is it?
Yeah. And it allows itself to be earned. It's a movie that you ask a lot of questions like, you know, why is this woman licking her son's back? You know, why is this cop so anti-gay? And like, why is Bill Paxton in this movie? Yeah, like he turns up like a young Bill Paxton.
Yep.
I have a lot of questions. Yeah.
But it's like it's allowed to be earnest in what it is. And it's a complete wackadoo movie, but it's completely earnest. And I just feel like that's, again, old man. I feel like 80 years old tonight for some reason. And I just feel like movies now are not allowed to be that earnest. Mm-hmm. They have, like you just said, Laura, they have to be couched in layer upon layer of irony in order to kind of get its point across.
Well, that's actually part of why I liked, I don't know if you finished watching that movie Spontaneous, where about the kids that explode. And I thought that was, it has a little bit of the irony to it, but that is ultimately a very earnest, like love story and earnest story, like coming of age story. Mm-hmm. And it like broke my fucking ass wide open. Like I was weeping out of my ass. Yep. So like,
it makes me happy that people are discovering that movie. Cause I saw it, I reviewed it way back in September when it first came out and no one was really talking about it. And I'm like, this movie ripped my fucking heart out.
Yeah.
I stumbled on it randomly. I was like, I went like sorted into the horror genre on Amazon Prime and like was just like scrolling through because I was really bored one day last week and watched it and I just was completely caught off guard by how powerful it was.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It definitely, especially as someone that works in a public school and has like a daughter in a public school and my wife works in a public school, like it's one of those things where like we have 3 chances to be one of those statistics. So it hit in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Especially in not to keep talking about COVID, but like, I mean, it's basically a movie about a plague of sorts, similar to The Blob, you know, where people are sort of dealing with this inexplicable, horrible thing that's happening to them and how they cope with it.
Yeah. I still haven't seen it. It's highly bumping it up very high on my list right now.
But you will never stop crying.
Really?
No. You know, quiet.
I'm due for a good cry. Maybe that's what I'll watch tonight.
Like I literally was sobbing so hard. Yeah.
It didn't make me cry.
Oh, I cried.
But I did rewatch Toy Story 4 and the end of Toy Story 4 made me cry.
Yeah.
We all have our triggers.
Yeah. I watched Mitchell's versus the Machines last night with my kids.
Oh, I need to watch that still.
Oh, it's good. It's not as good as Into the Spider-Verse, but few movies are as good as that movie. But man, I was like, I don't know if I could go on this emotional journey. And then I went and it was.
So I wonder, do we have anything else on The Blob tonight?
I would like to talk about the motorcycle sewer chase scene.
Yes.
I don't know how that happened, but I loved it. And I was like, yes, this is like Terminator 2 and it's so much fun. And then how did he get in there? There's a brick wall right there. Like,
yeah, that was my question, and I wasn't sure if I missed something, but I'm like, how the fuck did he get his bike in the sewer? That's my main question.
I know. And I don't care, because it's fun.
Right. Yeah. The whole sequence rules.
That as a kid, my idea of what a sewer is like, I don't believe they're that big under the small town that they are living in. And yet it's big enough to have a motorcycle chase through, for them to be like wading through like chest deep water for, you know, I'm like, what? But as a kid, I was like, wow, this is really what sewers are like. And it makes me want to like open up my manhole and down the street and like check it out down there because it's exciting. But I'm like, no, that's probably not anywhere near as exciting as that.
Between this and it, there's just a lot of sewer action lately.
And it was Jason Takes Manhattan vibes for me too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Cause especially with like, and I also thought, okay, is the blob absorbing the water? Or is the blob dissolving in the water? Like it was very, I had some questions about it, but I like that the movie doesn't care. They're like,
it's a blob. It does blob rules.
Right.
That's true. Blob rules. My other movie that I fucking love is when they just all unload all of their guns into the manhole and it does nothing. It just makes it mad. It's like, that was so,
burst and for like it to go on. Tentacle.
Exactly. And it's like, see you in hell, blob. And then they all get blobbed for their hubris, you know.
We've kind of talked around it, but I do like the fact that Frank Darabont kind of threw in 2 King references.
Yes.
With Flag. And then he's never called this in the movie, but the old man, that the first victim, he's written in the script as Can Man. So it's sort of like Trash Can Man. So like there's some little hints there that, you know, Frank Darabont loved him some King.
Yeah. I like to unofficially consider this part of King's Dominion then. You know, just like it could all just be happening in the same universe as all the other King franchises.
Well, it reminded me of The Raft too, that the short story, especially when he's getting sucked down into the drain, you know, just and how long that took, you know. So of course, you know, odds are King was inspired by the original Blob for that. Is the original Blob corrosive?
Yeah.
Is it Blob you?
Yes. And the thing that, so the thing that I really like about both is when you first see the Blob, it's not really pink. It's sort of like iridescent or kind of clear when the old man picks it up out of the thing. Mm-hmm. One of the things I really liked about the original Blob was that it started out clear, and as it dissolved more and more people, it got redder and redder and redder, because it's how they kind of showed blood, because it's literally dissolving them and taking on the hue of blood. And so I love that in this they kind of started the same way and then it went pink, and the idea that they wanted to kind of get across is that this is sort of like a stomach turned inside out is how they looked at the blob, is sort of like this inside out stomach that is dissolving people with stomach acid.
Which I can totally, now that you say that, I'll never be able to unsee it. That's perfect. It's so gross.
Yeah, it really is. But I guess one of the last things I really wanted to mention is that because this movie is so anti-authoritarian and so kind of an FU to the way that the people that are trying to protect us fail miserably, we have this ending where the Reverend gets it. And all of a sudden, he's looking at it as a doomsday, you know, scenario. And I'm so young. Terry was very upset, but watching this again, I am still upset every single time I see it that we don't have a sequel where it's like tackling the blob through like some doomsday cult. Can you imagine how bonkers that would be?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. We should write that, like, because now would be the time on these 30 year cycles.
I know.
You know, the 80s was obsessed with the 50s and now we're obsessed with the 80s. So let's fucking do this thing. And the priest could be like a really old man and like he's like, and then like, you know,
like revival.
I actually did look it up because I was curious if, you know, I was like, oh, could they do, you know, a remake now or like a reboot and kind of, you know, do a sort of sequel the way the Halloween series is. Mm-hmm. But he unfortunately passed away in 1999, so they'd have to get a lookalike. But
yeah,
I mean, I would love to see it. You know, he's been waiting for God to give him a sign. Mm-hmm. And then somehow in the year 2021, he's kept this little blobby in his jar for this entire time, and he's ready to unleash it on the world. I mean, how amazing would that be?
Yeah, it's like you could just write. I mean, it just writes itself.
It does.
Yeah,
it does. Yeah, it's like that meme where it's like Friday the 14th, you know, or Friday the 12th, and it's like every day. It's like, nope, not blob day. Maybe tomorrow, you know.
Finally, 2021.
It's blob day. Yeah! Right. I mean, you know, after 2020,
Shawnee and Kevin Dillon have to come back. You know.
Ooh. Oh yes,
start growing that mullet, Kevin.
Yeah, he has to have the mullet. If you don't have the mullet, that you're mullet. Not that character. It's so like firm and like, mm-hmm. you know, like it's just like so shapely, you know, like a lot of mullets kind of like they get a little scraggly at certain parts, but that whole thing is just very self-contained
hair extensions. Yeah. from what I understand.
Oh, makes really sense. Mm. Well, you know, it's not easy to grow a mullet and then you have a mullet, so you know.
Right.
You know, unless you're a professional wrestler in the 1980s or in a hair metal band, there's really no, or Joe Dirt, there's really no need to ever have a mullet.
Oh, yeah. Fashion mullets are a thing now.
Are they?
Oh, yeah. It's a big thing. Mm. Check out the gram. Look at those zoomers. Fashion mullets.
Oh. I also want to give a shout out to Snow Horror, because anytime you can work snow into a horror movie, I just eat it up. So. Hooray. Even though I wish there was maybe some blood in that snow, but that's when I really love it. But, you know, yay.
Also want to give a shout out to the yo-yo, the projectionist.
Yes, I wrote that in my notes.
Frank Collison.
That was a great moment.
And getting sucked up into and then just sort of falls down. Love that. Mm-hmm. Love that moment.
Great gag.
Yeah.
Again, as well as the sewers being ginormous under the town, the vents in this old... You could like literally like look through it. It's like he's an aliens, right? In the way. Mm-hmm. I'm like, is this really what vents are like?
I don't know enough about HVAC systems to tell you.
I don't think they are, though.
Everything in movies is like at least 1.5 times larger than it should be. Like anytime there's a scene with an airplane and people are like able to fully stand up and like spread their shoulders, and I'm like, no, that's right. Not an airplane. Like,
yeah, they got to fit the cameras, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else that we want to talk about with the blob, or shall we move on?
I'm ready to blob on down the road.
Blobbing on down the road. We're sucking up all of the sections as we go along.
Yeah. Last thing, super quick. I think Mark Irwin, who shot this movie, also shot Scream. And I think that is like one of the reasons why it does a really good job of capturing like a small town feel, like very much like Woodsboro. It definitely he's able to shoot in a way that makes like the environment feel like very lived in, so you get a real sense of it. So yeah, props to Mark Irwin.
I guess since we're giving him some props too, I also would like to give props to the editor of this film, the film editing, because there's a couple really kind of choice moments I loved in the beginning where we have the auditorium screaming and chanting and shouting for, you know, the football game. And that's Chris Cutt with Mr. Flag trying to race across the thing, and it's almost as if the crowd is cheering him on, and of course he spectacularly wipes out. And then there's a moment later on where the can man, he gets the blob, and all of a sudden it like lurches onto his hand, and it's Chris Cutt immediately with the kid slurping up Jell-O. Like, just a perfect moment.
Some little nice match on actions. Yeah.
that's like really knowing what your movie is trying to do.
Yes. This whole movie feels like a very composed thought. Like it was thought through from the script to the editing to the effects to the roles. I mean, it's just good filmmaking.
Yeah,
totally agree. Well, and now it's time for an uplifting moment.
Just the comedy uplifting moment, and then it was like
getting all that evilness out.
One day, maybe. This is an uplifting moment where we share any grounding and coping techniques or any self-care that's been working for us recently. Grounding and coping techniques are the little tips, tricks, mantras, or practices that help us get through the tough days and the tough moments. And self-care is anything we do to make us feel good or to feel better. And my self-care, I talked about this on social media a little while ago, but I have just been binging the shit out of the Final Destination franchise. I saw 4 and 5 for the first time this week, and they were fun. The first three are still my favorite. But man, I got all the way through, and I've had them on in the background as I've been doing work, but I finished 5. And they have that montage of all of the other movies. And I was like, I got to watch the first one again. So I started the first one again, and I'm now on 3 again. And man, it's just like I've got these really big deadlines at work. It's a lot of like proofreading, you know. So it's just been the nicest thing to have on in the background. And then I look over at see like Devin Sawa, and it's just it's such a fun franchise.
Had such a huge crush on him.
Oh, gosh, me too. And then I watched Hunter Hunter, and I was like, whew.
It's the best series.
Daddy.
It's the best franchise of the first decade of the 2000s.
Yeah, for sure.
Final Destination 4 is considered like the weakest of the 5 movies, and even that is pretty watchable. Like it's really, I think, the most consistent and most fun and I honestly smartest of like any of the franchises of the first decade. Like absolutely love the Final Destination movies.
And like speaking of the blob, like they know what they're trying to do. They know what their movie and their franchise is about, and they for the most part stick to it. And I think while the first one will always have my heart and I absolutely love it, I think my favorite is 2.
Like, 2 is just so mean. I love it.
I know. And I love the cars. And oh my God.
It has such a dark sense of humor, kind of going back to the blob. It like has that sort of skewering meanness to the way that it presents the kills in such a I agree. I'm with you there.
Yeah. Ah, sweet. Would anyone else care to share?
I'll just say that I'm at the end of the week that I took off of from work. So my self-care this last week was taking the whole damn week off. I think I probably said that last Sunday when we were recording, and now I'm at the tail end and I'm very upset. So, you know, that's the cautionary tale of all self-care is at some point it ends. You have to go back to life and it blows ass.
We go back to self-abuse.
Yes. I look forward to the eventual time on the unknown future when I can stop working for a few days again.
So I'm going to do a bit of gratitude. I think one of the, I don't know if I ever talked about like gratitude and gratitude journals and like the benefits of them is like, they actually do help manage like depression and anxiety. They're like, if you can give things that you're grateful for, they can help alleviate some of the things that really stress you out. And help change some cognitive distortions. So if you follow me on Twitter, you know that I blew out my knee this week. Like 1 week ago, I just like at 6 a.m. fell on the top stair, letting the dog out to pee at 6 a.m. And by Wednesday, I could no longer put any weight on my leg and like went to the emergency room. And for the past 4 days, they haven't told me what's wrong with it. They think they know, but this being our healthcare system, I can't get an MRI until 2 weeks after I went into the ER. So,
oh my God.
Yay, American healthcare. Right? Yeah. So awesome. But honestly, like my wife has been incredible at like just making sure I'm taken care of. Like, do you have your meds? Are you comfortable? Can I do this for you? Like, just like looking out for me. And it's been really nice. And we'll just like sit on the sofa and we've been like binge watching Whitechapel and Murders at the White House on White House Farm on HBO. And it's just been like our time, and like it's just been nice. Like I joked because like a couple months ago she had surgery she was putting off for like a long, long time, and I had to like basically like do everything for her. And I joked, like, just so you know, when you get better, I immediately plan to like break my leg or something. So you have to.
Oh wow.
So careful what you jinxed yourself. I did. So yeah, it's been really nice to know that like my partner's there to like look out for me and make sure that you know, things are going well.
Well, that's good. And I'm glad to hear you're feeling a little better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A little bit better. Can hobble around. Can't dance a jig yet. But definitely.
That's next week.
Yes. Definitely hobble around. How about you, Terry?
One of the things when I feel stressed, I like to listen to music, and I've just been going down kind of a queer artist rabbit hole of King Princess and also Kay Flay. So I've been like, they both have been releasing some new music, and I've just been sort of zoning out to them and just, you know, putting on headphones and sort of like trying to put everything else aside and just focus on listening to music, which one of the things that I have issues with is like, there's so much constant bombardment of things. And so what I've found is that if I'm like listening to music that I can actually, you know, relate to and sort of focus on, it helps me to kind of tune out everything and recenter. And another thing that I've been doing, and again, this is very niche, but editing podcasts. I don't know if you guys experience this, but when I'm sitting there and I'm trying to get out all of the ums or trying to like get rid of spaces and make everything flow good, it's one of the few times where I'm so focused on what I'm doing that everything else is just like gone. And it really brings me into this moment of almost like zen. And it's been really helpful the last month or so to sort of like center myself.
Yeah.
So go host a podcast, everyone, if you
learn to edit.
Yeah, there's like, that's kind of how I feel about when I edit writing too. It's like, there's a power in feeling like I have control over my words, you know, and because I think that's a huge part of me processing, but just knowing I said this, I can, you know, I can take that out. It just is empowering. And yeah, you have to focus. Every time my mind drifts, there's an and I'm like, and it zaps me back in, you know?
So Terry and Jen, because I edit the other show I do, can you recognize your at this point by the wave they make?
Oh yeah.
I just see like
illy go that. And then do you, when you edit, do you listen to yourself? I do like 1.25 speed now. And I actually love how I sound at 1.25 speed. Like, I'm like, I really love my voice. Like, I sound like a bit, I don't like my normal voice, but at 1.25, I'm like, I dig this.
I don't know how to set it to 1.25.
I've never done that.
Do you use Audacity?
Mm-mm. I use GarageBand.
Okay. Ah, okay.
Yeah. But I can tell the difference between, like, I know what Laura's ums look like. I know what my ums look like. And I know what your ums look like, too.
I think we're at like three very distinct places in the vocal register also. Yes. So like that is helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, future Jim. Well, we want to know.
Well, now you're not going to be able to not say it.
It is funny, like getting to know like the thought processes and like the little vocal tics that you have.
Oh, yeah.
It's really interesting. And
it
like tells you a lot about like I feel like I know you two better because I like listen to, you know, just are analyzing. It's just, it's interesting. Yeah. You know,
you can see all of my neuroses working through the way I talk.
And, and I see mine too. And I'm like, oh.
I would say like the same rule that goes into like when you're a therapist, like one of the cardinal ethical rules is you never, ever, ever date a client ever. Like you just don't do it. It's like I would say never date like a co-host of a podcast because their weaknesses and can use them to
you don't shit where you sleep. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. The crassest possible way to put that. Okay. Yeah.
We had a rule in college, you can't date your accompanist.
The best story I heard in grad school from my advisor, she told us in a class how she was interning at like an inpatient ward and one of the other clinicians like fell in love with one of the patients that was there long term and like gave up her license and was like, nope, I'm in love with this person. That's who I want to be with. And they're like, this guy, like, you really giving all this up? She's like, yep, that's what I'm going to do. So
I guess the heart wants what it wants.
Yeah. I guess that's... I hope they're doing okay. You know,
oh, they're both dead. No,
was
I'm just
it
kidding.
Worth it? Yeah.
He got eaten by the blob.
They did. True. Got blobbed minute after she laid out.
That blob was psychosis.
That is the real blob of us all.
That's the real blob, yeah. The real blob is inside you all along. Okay.
That's true. Now I'm in my head. So we want to know what you think. Have you ever seen a meteor, man-made or otherwise? Have you ever listened to a Walkman inside a movie theater, which was another to mention?
This is what I mean by that kid was shady. I don't know what his fucking deal was.
What's he listening to? Anyways, what is your current self-care or anything else that's on your mind? And you can share all of these things and more with us by following us at PsychoApod. And just watching for prompts on that stuff. Or, you know, just reach out. It's fun. You can also join our Facebook group, the Psychoanalysis Podcast Support Group. It is a private and moderated group where we can share about episodes, other mental health topics, or just whatever else you're thinking about. And you can also email us at psychoapod@gmail.com if you'd like to share privately. And speaking of things to share, our homework question for this episode is, what was your worst first date? There's too many rhymes in that sentence for me. What was the worst first date you've ever been on? Did it involve a blob? Although that might be opening the door for some PsychoApod After Dark answers.
I had a woman, upon dropping her off, ask if my sister was available. So
that's interesting. Yeah. Was she? Yeah.
She was not, and I'm like, but so that was.
I mean, it's very forward of them. I think mine was probably this guy insisting that we watch the movie The Aristocrats, even though I explained to him that I'd already seen the movie The Aristocrats and was familiar with the content of The Aristocrats. Mm. That's all.
This is the Aristocrats, not the
Aristocrats. Not to be confused. One has Gilbert Gottfried and one does not.
Watch the one without Gilbert Gottfried. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Iago or nothing for me. Mine, speaking of Final Destination, I went on a first date and was wearing a maxi dress and the hem of that dress got stuck in the elevator. And
oh, no.
I was like, oh, shit, it's going to rip my dress off. But he had a pocket knife and he set me free. And it was not a love connection despite that. But, you know,
that is a pretty smooth move, though.
Mm-hmm. It was. Yeah. I think he thought that was like his way in. And I was like, sorry, I still don't like
that. I'm not comfortable with you having a knife, even though it was helpful in this one specific scenario. Goodbye. Thank you.
That's true. Yeah, so that, and Terry, if you want to share, you can.
I mean, this is one time I you know, was under the sewer with some girl riding on a motorcycle, but
yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Chasing.
Well, we've all been there.
Yeah. You know, the blob's chasing you and there's all these like scientists and military men chasing you. A typical Friday night. I don't really have any exciting ones, unfortunately. Yeah. Or fortunately.
Okay. Fortunately.
Yeah, exactly. So what are we watching next? I was just going to say, speaking of sewer motorcycle chase scenes, although that has nothing to do with the next movie we're watching. we are continuing our theme of residential treatment, and we are watching Unsane, which I still have not seen, and I'm really excited to watch.
That's a good one.
I love how our themes, the two themes we have is Lara doesn't remember when she's seen the movie. And it's like, yeah, it's a first time watch.
Right. Yeah, I know. And I've never seen it. Yeah. Yep. We are nothing if not consistent.
We are who we are.
That's true. Yeah. So make sure to watch Unsane. Yeah, I'm excited for it. I love Claire Foy. So we are a member of the Consequence Podcast Network. You can find us and lots of other great pods by going to consequence.net. And Terry, I know you have a lot of exciting things coming up. So where can we find you online and what is coming up for Scarred for Life, We Are Horror, and Gaily Dreadful?
Well, there's a couple things coming up. First of all, June is Pride Month, and every year at Gaily Dreadful, we host a bunch of articles from LGBTQ plus critics and writers kind of promoting their work while we're also raising money for a fundraiser. And this year, our focus is, because of all the anti-trans exclusionary bills that have been coming up, we are focusing on the Transgender Law Center. So we're hopefully going to be raising a bunch of money that month. Also on the 14th, so the day after, if you're listening to this right now, the day after, we're going to be having Mixtape Massacre reached out, and we are doing a t-shirt together.
Oh, wow.
And all of the proceeds of that are going to go to the Transgender Law Center, and it's a really cool design. So if you're at all interested in them, the day after this podcast goes live, for 2 weeks, you can pre-order the shirt. Other than that, Scarred for Life, we have a bunch of cool guests coming up for the next month. I'm not 100% sure who they are yet, but we do have some episodes recorded with Andrew Lassane. That's sort of the kind of a graphic artist who kind of does a lot of shoot custom designs with the horror community. Mm-hmm. We have an interview coming up with Sapphire Sandalo, who hosts Stories with Sapphire.
Something Scary.
Yeah, she used to work for Something Scary, and she has started doing that on her own with a podcast. So we have an interview with her and just a bunch of filmmakers coming up. So there's a lot coming. And of course, the new We Are Horror is going to be launching in June, and it's all about the aughts. So
that sounds so fun. Yeah.
A lot of stuff.
I saw that announcement. I was like, Ryan is losing his mind.
Oh, yeah. That's all Ryan Larson right there. I'm excited, but that is all Ryan.
Right. So check all of that out, and we will post links to everything too. And I just have to say too, I'm always just so amazed at how you use your platform to help others in the community, which I think is really inspiring. So
thank you. I try.
I agree.
And Mike, where can we find you?
Sure. So as usual, you can find me on Twitter at @Mike_Snoonian. As this show comes out, the Pod and the Pendulum has just passed year number 2.
Oh, congrats.
And 100 plus episodes in. So really proud of it, like really proud of the growth of the show. Like even though we've gone from weekly to bi-weekly, we're still doubling our listenership year over year. And it's a completely independent pod, which I'm really proud of. So Lindsay, Travis, and I have planned out the next year's worth of episodes. So as we wrap up the Evil Dead coverage by the end of May, we actually have, for Memorial Day, we have a script reading of Cary Fukunaga's It Chapter 1 unproduced script with about 20 people providing parts for it. It was a lot of fun. I will challenge anyone to get to the end of it because it becomes a bit of a clusterfuck by page 40. But over the next year, we're going to be transitioning from Evil Dead to the Conjuring movies. We're going to cover the 2 Unfriended films. October will be a theme month where we go weekly. We're then going to cover Psycho, And then we're going to cover Saw as a treat for Lindsay because she adores those movies.
You can have a little Saw as a treat.
I've never gotten past part two.
Yep, me neither.
So that'll be a first time watch for me. But yeah, like we have a year's worth of stuff coming up. Our whole thing is we want to promote voices that are different, definitely from my own voice. So we're always reaching out to persons of color, to women, to the LGBTQ plus community for our guests, because, you know, one of the mission statements when we started 2 years ago was to bring different perspectives. And I'll say, like, once a week we get like tagged in a message like, hey, I found it would be one of our, like, our one of our guests will get a message saying, we found your show when you guested on the Pod and the Pendulum, and we really like what you're doing. And that's been really one of the joys of doing the show, is like helping other people get their voices out there a little bit. And honestly, like, I've made like a tremendous amount of like friends in the community. So I'm really proud of my little baby, and I can't wait to see where it goes for the next few years.
That's so exciting.
Laura, congratulations.
Where can we find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at underalls, UNDERALLS. Much like the goo that's all over you when you look down your pants. Wait a minute. These aren't underpants. This is a blob. Yeah. It's covering my steaming crevice. No.
Well, again, done. Nice.
You can find me on Twitter at underalls, UNDERALLS. And I'm occasionally on Halloweenies, as well as Stephen King's favorite Stephen King podcast, The Losers Club. Although not that often, so I can't take any credit for all the amazing things that happened in the last week. But
oh my God.
So blessed, #blessed to be a part of it.
That was amazing to see.
Oh, I yeah.
Fucking believe it.
I thought I was going to die. I still might die. Yeah, because now every time I do an episode, I'm like, is he listening? Does he
know what's happening?
Hi, Uncle Steve.
I know. Hi.
I'll never say a negative thing again. I promise.
I know. Well, you can find me at Jim Ferratu and on the aforementioned The Losers Club, which is all about Stephen King. And we have a lot of really exciting things coming up, including a Firestarter commentary, which anyone who's talked to me for more than like 5 minutes knows I have a lot of thoughts about Firestarter, and I'm kind of obsessed with it. So I'm really excited for that. And we also just recorded an episode today, so it's probably out by now, about addiction and recovery in King's Dominion, just like a smorgasbord of all kinds of different texts with those themes in it, which I thought went, I was really proud of that conversation. It was a little, you know, kind of tough to talk about some stuff, but it's a good one. So check that out. And you can also find me writing about strong female antagonists at a blog, and I should have a new one out as we speak, knock on wood. So yeah, that's where I write about the villainous women of horror. So
oh, yeah.
Check that out. Yay. And yeah, so that is our episode on the blob.
Yay.
I really want a blob sound effect, I think, that I need to, you know.
We'll find, yeah, you gotta just get the gurgling, slimy gurgling. Yeah.
Terry, thank you so much for joining us and for choosing this blobtacular movie. So much fun.
Thank you for having me. This was a blast.
Great to have you.
And listeners, thank you so much for spending time with us. Please make sure to take care of yourselves and take care of each other. And with that, let's sign off. We came here to chew blobble gum. One more. And take care of ourselves. And we're all out of blobble gum.
Consequence Podcast Network.